Oh, John, John, you silly fool. Can't you see it's you I love? Don't you know that if the whole sky were raining $100 bills, I'd go stand under a tree with you, darling, because you're my bright, shiny penny. Cut, I'll be in my dressing room.
What's wrong, doll?
What's wrong? Nothing. That's the problem, Al. I'm the only starlet in Hollywood with no scandal.
It doesn't matter, Angel Face. Bright Shiny Penny is going to be the biggest hit of 1943, and the name Dorothy Del Monte will be in the lips of every American with a spare nickel to plunk down at the ticket window.
But the magazines don't cover me. I need a whiff of scandal, like everybody else. Maybe I could poison my husband.
You got no husband.
What happened to him?
Somebody poisoned him.
Do you see what I'm saying? That could have been me. Put it around that I've got a drinking problem.
Everybody has a drinking problem.
Say I'm an infomaniac.
That's Tallulah Bankhead.
Say that I use cocaine.
That's Tallulah Bankhead.
Say that I'm bisexual.
That's Tallulah.
I get it. All the good ones are taken. I've got it. Say I do yoga.
Who's he?
It's a thing. I think it's from India. You twist your body around and say that I don't eat meat anymore.
Sugar, this is getting weird.
And I'm adopting a baby from Africa.
Baby, I agree. A few rumors can really spark a career in this crazy town, but you're going too far. People are going to think you're nuts.
I don't care. Tell the world I've given up coffee and booze and cigarettes. I'm going to be the vanguard of a new kind of Hollywood celebrity.
You're not going to actually do any of that stuff, are you?
Of course not. Let's listen to a radio show about the history of Hollywood gossip, a controversial opera, and the future of baseball. And now, the man who took all of Jackie Coogan's money, Colin McEnroe.
I didn't take all of his money. I invested all of his money, and it was 1929, and some things went wrong. And he wound up fine anyway. Why do people bring up Jackie Coogan all the time? Why do people throw Jackie Coogan in my face? All right, so welcome to The Scramble. And we are going to have a three-part conversation. But I think there's actually a sort of a connecting theme. I can't really say we really designed it that way. But if there is a connecting theme, it's the notion that art or culture needs a certain amount of scandal, that that to prosper, the art needs scandal. So in our second segment, we're going to talk about The Death of Klinghoffer, a controversial opera at the Met. But we're going to talk about it from kind of a different point of view. Our guest basically kind of believes that it's sort of an everybody wins situation. Everybody can either raise money or cultivate enthusiasm, ranging from opera itself to the ADL to whoever. Everybody makes out okay because everybody's so excited about this. In our final segment, we're going to talk about baseball. It's the World Series. My personal belief is that people do not care about the World Series anymore. Brian Curtis, our guest, will tell me otherwise. One of the things that I believe is that, you know, one sign of baseball's health was probably the steroid scandal, because people really cared about how Roger Clemens threw the ball so fast or why Mark McGwire could hit things out of the park. Well, for Hollywood, scandal is kind of a constant. Or is it? I mean, I think that's sort of one of the places we're going to go with Anne Helen Peterson, a features writer for BuzzFeed, the author of Scandals of Classic Hollywood, Sex, Deviance, and Drama from the Golden Age of American Cinema. And one of the things that attracted us to Anne Helen Peterson, in fact, we sort of feel as though we've been looking for her for most of our lives as a radio show, is that she left academia after writing a dissertation on the history of the gossip industry to do long-form journalism about this kind of stuff, which is exactly the kind of thing that we do with some frequency here. So Anne Helen Peterson, I'm very excited to make your acquaintance.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So let's sort of talk about the nature of scandal in the so-called golden or classic age of Hollywood, let's say 20s, 30s, 40s, early 50s. And maybe as we go along, we can contrast it a little bit to today. I take it that one of the real differences is that to a certain degree today, George Clooney manages his affairs however well he manages them. And by affairs, I mean everything from business affairs to romantic liaisons. And is, you know, I mean, he has people. You know, but he's basically a self-actualized entity. Whereas for most of the period that you're writing about, it's a more patriarchal system, right? There are a lot of people deciding who you are if you're a Hollywood star, and you might be pretty low on that list.
Yeah. It was definitely ruled by committee. You know, there wasn't one person who was the head of the studio who, I mean, those they were all male, who was making the judgment call about what kind of star performer would be. But at the same time, like a star was essentially raw performance material, and they would take that raw material and shape it into something. And that new something, that new star would have a different name, have a different hairline a lot of times. Rita Hayworth famously had electrolysis on her hairline to make her look less, quote-unquote, Latin. And and also meant to mean something like a particular notion of femininity. So someone could be a vamp or a good girl or a great mother, that sort of thing. And as you said, I think the style of management has really changed in that all of the functions that the studio used to perform for that star are now functions that each star has to employ, you know, an agent and a manager and a publicist and a trainer to do all of those things that were formerly performed by the studio.
So one has people. But back in those days, as you looked at Valentino or Clara Bow or Dorothy mm-hmm. Dandridge or Mae West or Jean Harlow or James Dean, all these people had to varying degrees scandal attached to them. But it doesn't seem as though you could really inscribe a particular rule that determined that, right? I mean, on the one hand, you know, you think of Fairbanks and Pickford. I mean, the scandal kind of was, I guess, that maybe they weren't, you know, the romantic couple that they appeared to be on the screen, but so that's sort of, you know, a normative thing. You know, we all want to believe in love, and we all want to believe, and maybe in the 1920s, we especially wanted to believe in a certain kind of couple. Mae West got in trouble for being essentially who she always claimed she was.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing about Fairbanks and Pickford is that they both divorced their spouses to be with one another, and it should have been a huge scandal. I mean, they're the two biggest stars in the world. And what they did really effectively was frame their romance in terms of true love. And so there was a sort of mild scandal as the 20s waned and their marriage unraveled. But at the same time, there should have been a huge, huge scandal in the early 20s, and they really effectively managed that. But someone like Mae West, I mean, she was scandalous just because she was She's a buxom woman who also wrote all of her own material, and her entire image was really underpinned by sex and the suggestion thereof.
But I mean, one wonders whether that ultimately, I mean, apart from occasionally having to spend 8 nights in jail or something, whether that actually hurt Mae West. In other words, we've always used movies to dream. So, you know, what do we want to dream about? Well, one of the things we want to dream about is, and particularly in her era, you know, a world of license, you know, a world where one's passions and proclivities could be pretty freely indulged, maybe more freely than they were being indulged in Winesburg, Ohio, or wherever her movie was being played at that given moment. So that's fine, then, if she has a scandalous life. I mean, once in a while, she gets a ticket written or something like that, but it seems inherently necessary for her to be scandalous.
Well, you know, the fascinating thing about Mae West, actually, was that it was her roles and the things that she wrote that were scandalous, but she kept a squeaky clean image offstage. I mean, she didn't drink. She wasn't associated. I mean, she was associated with some prize fighters, but that was mostly that she liked to go to the prize fights, which is explained by the fact that she had a father who used to be a prize fighter. But she, you know, went to church every Sunday, and really the studio, her studio Paramount, really emphasized the fact that she was nothing like that wanton woman that she played on screen. And that was the same as well for so many of those stars who played very sexually loose, for lack of a better word, women in the early 30s.
So it's sort of, I mean, if you think about that, and if you think about the pattern, if there's a pattern, it's that frequently one is not what one appears to be on screen. If you appear to be squeaky clean on stage, then it turns out your life is much more tawdry and sordid. And if you appear to be this wild libertine on stage or on screen, it turns out that you're home with a glass of milk.
Right. Well, but the thing that the studios tried to do over and over again was when the image on screen was squeaky clean, to try to promote that, yes, in fact, this is how this person is off screen too, because then it seems less like acting, less performative, and more just like, here's an extension of who this person really is. Whereas the more ironic or the harder thing to pull off was when you were like, okay, well, we said that for these other stars, that yes, there's no difference between how they are in real life and how they are on screen. But, oh, these other ones, when they're bad on screen, actually they're still good in real life. So the idea was that every single star was good and domestic and heterosexual and totally vanilla in their quote-unquote real life.
Well, you know, and I feel as though I was trying to think what's changed and what hasn't. Mm-hmm. And you know, you write about Montgomery Clift. Okay, so there's an example of a guy who was depicted as this very heterosexual, dating kind of wild guy with a lot of or playboy with a lot of dates and a lot of sexual magnetism on screen. We now know the real story. You could say the same thing about Rock Hudson, but kind of in a different way.
Right.
But it was essential, it was, as a matter of business, as a matter of keeping everything going, that the homosexuality be swept under the rug or really sort of kept tamped down as much as possible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, for someone like Montgomery Clift or especially Rock Hudson, it was an open secret in Hollywood. But still, you know, Rock Hudson denied it until, you know, he died still denying that he was homosexual.
And you know, I feel as though that might be one thing that kind of hasn't changed that much. Yes, we've got, you know, Neil Patrick Harris and Heche and Rosie O'Donnell and Portia de Rossi and Ellen DeGeneres. And I mean, I could reel off a bunch of names and you could get a lot more of them than I could. But the reality is, if you look at the most bankable people in Hollywood, they're not. And one has a sense that there are some of them, and obviously the names that often float up are those of Tom Cruise and John Travolta. Those are some of them where there will be this sort of lifelong battle between
right.
them and people who say that they're gay, and that you still, from a certain point of view in terms of sheer bankability, it's still pretty tough to be gay.
Yeah, well, I think that's in part because worldwide and in America, the idea of masculinity is still really wed to heterosexuality. I think that's changing, but I think, you know, if we're still talking about not just urban areas, but like all of America, that correlation still holds. And, you know, when Tom Cruise, he was accused, or not accused is the wrong word. There was someone who sold the story of an affair with Tom Cruise, a homosexual affair, to a Spanish newspaper. And Tom Cruise sued for libel, and his claim was that his image as a Hollywood star and his earning capacity was so wed to the idea of being a masculine, heterosexual ideal. And he won because he said, you know, like, this person has impinged upon my ability to play that role. And so he won that case. Now, that's specific to, you know, Spanish court, but it still, I think, underlines the idea that Cruise has to maintain this very specific image of white heterosexuality in order to maintain his image.
I'm going to bring up my one sort of cultural theory about all this that's very, very poorly worked out. One of the things I believe is, you know, there's all sort of a counter narrative, and that's what we're really kind of talking about here. And a lot of times the counter narrative is sort of the thing that's forbidden, the thing that's we're not supposed to know about, and maybe the thing that we can't have ourselves. And so in the 40s and 50s, 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, the hidden narrative was, you know, Tyrone Power as a womanizer, Isabella Rossellini, Ingrid Bergman, running around with European men, and people leaving their wives and husbands and leading these kinds of wild lives and having cocaine problems. And
yep.
I mean, we were joking about Tallulah Bankhead in the intro, but I mean, you know,
right.
so that was the counter narrative, because in fact, what you could show on screen was a little bit circumscribed, you know, there
yeah.
were decency codes and stuff like that. So the idea was off screen must be really crazy. And
right.
it seems to me that, you know, if you look at the big stars today, you know, it's Jennifer Lawrence and Leo DiCaprio and Sandra Bullock and Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie and Tom Hanks, you know, and Brad Pitt and Channing Tatum and Matt Damon and George Clooney and Hugh Jackman and Ben Affleck. These are like family people for the most part. And,
oh,
you know,
yeah,
and they
totally.
They're all vegetarians and they don't do and they do yoga. And it's sort of like that's the counter narrative right now. You can show anything on the screen. You can show
right.
anything you want. So the counter narrative is Gwyneth Paltrow. Look how incredibly together and healthy I am.
Right. No, and even someone, you know, like arguably Robert Downey Jr. is actually the biggest male star right now, given like box office. And he, you know, has a completely sober life, just had another baby, you know, like he is the opposite of the narrative that that structured his image even 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, that's the most bankable narrative. And the newest practitioner of that is Matthew McConaughey, who's still
right.
weird, but he seems like he's weird within this family context. And,
totally.
You know, I mean, he's always thanking his kids. And,
well, and that's why it's fascinating what's happened with George Clooney, is that for so long he maintained this image of like, of the cat, like of this bachelor cat, and even he is now kind of subject to domesticity and cover of People magazine with his wedding photos.
Right. So that's the secret dream, is that we could all be healthy vegetarian monogamists. we're going to sort of switch topics just a little bit anyway, but Anne Helen Peterson, one thing that we often do like with a writer like you, somebody who's really staying on top of popular culture, and I know that in particular you write a lot about television. You taught a whole course about Mad Men. So tell us, what are you watching right now?
I am actually watching very little network television, so... I don't think I'm unique in any way in that. Most of the shows that I'm watching are actually available either on extended premium cable or not available on TV at all, so via Amazon. So my favorite, actually, probably of the last couple months, is a show called Transparent. Mm. And it stars Jeffrey Tambor from Arrested Development as a transsexual who comes out to his kids and starts living as a woman. But it's about much more than that. It's a beautifully shot and scored kind of meditation on what it means to be selfish or giving or all sorts of things. And it just, like, the feel of California is really, really present there. And it's just a half an hour. And if you have Amazon Prime, it's right there for you to watch all of it right now.
I think you're also watching The Affair, which I didn't see last night's episode, if there was one last night. I forget what night they drop on. But and I have a very ambivalent relationship with this series so far. But what's your take on it?
Yeah, I haven't seen last night's either. I've only seen the first two. And, you know, I was drawn to it because the two leads are people who have given very compelling performances in other shows. The male lead is McNulty from The Wire, and the female lead plays this kind of dastardly villain on the show Luther, which is on Netflix. And it's just about an affair. Like, it doesn't seem like it's that interesting of a topic, but the way that they do it is kind of Kurosawa-esque in that they show half of the show from one perspective for the first half an hour from the perspective of the male, and then the second half is from the other perspective. And I've been fascinated by how it doesn't seem as gimmicky as I thought it would be.
I think that the different perspectives are really interesting. And so in each case, the person who's telling the story casts the other person, the other part of the affair, as the more aggressive, wilder, again, more libertine kind of person. And there are lots of little visual cues that you can watch for that are really interesting. I mean, they're even dressed differently. For example, in the second episode, Dominic West, McNulty from The Wire, when he tells the story of this big party, he's dressed rather casually, kind of, you know, nice jacket, open neck shirt. When his paramour tells the story, he's in a tie, he's in a suit and tie and looks rather formal. And to me, what's interesting about this show, although I think I kind of object to the way they do it, is it purports to be also about socioeconomic class, right?
Right.
He's from a very wealthy family. He, in fact, is not a wealthy man. He's a school teacher and a kind of unsuccessful writer of literary fiction. But he's from this immensely wealthy family. And his wife, I think, she does something where she makes a lot of money. I forget what it is. But meanwhile, the woman who's going to become his lover is supposedly from this dirt poor part of Long Island. But what that really means is she owns this house that is, you know, that's
gorgeous.
Sort of gorgeous house. It's rustic, gorgeous, and this kind of enchanting dump in some part of the eastern part of Long Island that is, I mean, it's got to be worth millions and millions of dollars. And her husband owns this sprawling horse farm, you know, where he has riding lessons for the rich children who come to stay out there, except that, you know, but they're sort of working people. She works in this kind of, you know, diner kind of place, and he, you know, does horseback riding lessons or whatever. But it's not plausible, really. I mean,
that
socioeconomic divide, I'm babbling. I should let you talk.
No, I mean, it's very typical of the way that most television does class, which is the way that they signal that someone is working class is they, like, have a beard and, work as a waitress, but aren't ever dirty and always look great and just live, like, I don't know, I always think of Gossip Girl, where the way that you knew that someone was working class is that they lived in Brooklyn.
Right.
So, I agree with you that it's kind of a hackneyed and stereotypical rendering of the way that these sorts of stories go. But I do like the conceit that, you know, we tell ourselves stories about the way that a romance or anything in our lives happens, and to see that rendered is really fascinating.
Yeah, no, I think that part of it's fascinating, and the manufacture of memory. But I'll just whine about this one last time and say, this is what the socioeconomic thing is what I refer to as the Nancy Meyer problem, which, you know, I like movies like As Good as It Gets or Something's Gotta Give or whatever the one with Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin was, and I would throw into that a movie like The Kids Are All Right. But there are never any actual poor people in these movies. Always have these fabulous living environments.
Yeah. And you can tell always by the fact that they all have perfect teeth.
Right. Everybody has, there's sort of a floor below which they do not sink. All right. We've got just a few more minutes with you. And I have to ask you about this. This is so fascinating. There's so many things that you've written about that are very interesting. But I do have to ask you about this BuzzFeed piece that you wrote about television criticism in the New York Times. I will preface this by saying Alessandra Stanley's actually been on this show. So I'm one of the few people apparently who's ever heard her voice. And I used to work with Neil Gensler. But I still think you've got some interesting points. And one of your points is, and I guess this was occasioned by a firestorm, which I completely missed, an Alessandra piece about the African-American showrunner Sondra Rhimes that was, I read it, and it is sort of interestingly tone deaf in certain ways and starts from a premise that's going to get people's hackles up about angry black women. But you sort of went from there to say it just that the New York Times has never had a high comfort level with television.
Right. Absolutely true.
And so see what you mean by that.
I mean, television until very recently was a really denigrated and low form of entertainment. And it's only been within the last 20 years, usually people mark it to around Twin Peaks. I mean, there were different types of what were called quality television before that. Mm-hmm. So the second golden age, which was like Mary Tyler Moore Show and that sort of thing in the 70s and also Hill Street Blues in the 1980s. But it wasn't really until Twin Peaks in 1990, but then really The Sopranos and the cultivation of HBO, which marketed itself, you know, as it's not TV, that there was this widespread legitimization of television as, you know, there's all these think pieces that compare television to novels, which is an effort to estrange it from its history as a popular medium that was filled with trash. You know, famously in 1962, Newton Minow, who's the head of the FCC, called television a vast wasteland, and that designation really clung to it for many decades.
So part of your thesis, and it's an interesting one, which is that because television for a long time had, as you say, no intellectual standing or very little intellectual standing, mm-hmm. and also kind of no auteurist theory about it either. It was just the sort of crap that came on when you turned on this piece of furniture in your living room, that there was no need to kind of even develop critical sensibilities about it. So one thing that the Times did was they would occasionally give the TV critic job to somebody who'd been some other kind of critic or somebody who hadn't even ever been a critic before. The idea being, if you could run the Beirut Bureau, or if you could, you know, be, I don't know, the lead national reporter about something, you could probably review television because it didn't exactly take a genius.
Yeah, it didn't merit any sort of specialization. And, you know, before, like, the critics, they had two longstanding critics from the beginning of the medium, essentially, until, like, the 90s, really. Mm. And those two men, they were well-versed in television because they had seen it all.
Right.
But what you have with Stanley is someone who has no background. And, I mean, there would be if they hired someone who used to be a foreign correspondent to be, let's say, the opera critic or the dance critic or the architecture critic, there would be an uproar because, obviously, that person hasn't been, you know, versed in the extensive history and the knowledge necessary to critique this, whereas this is just kind of like, if you can write, then you have something to say about television. And that is really at odds with the way that so many other publications have now started to treat television.
Right. So, I mean, and we're running out of time here, but just a couple other quick points worth making. Yeah, so first of all, you have people like Emily Nussbaum at The New Yorker, and I'm blocking the name of the woman I like so much at Slate.
Willa Paskin.
Yeah, Willa Paskin. She's been on this show. And so these are people, obviously, who've just really kind of trained in this, you know, they've trained in their sensibilities. They often write about shows knowledgeably and familiarly about shows that I think they could not have seen in their lifetime. times as, you know, real-time shows, but they've,
right.
they've sort of gone
right.
back. Just the way, as a film writer, you would go back and you would see Kurosawa, even if you weren't, you know, a contemporary. So they've sort of done that. And the other thing they do is that they sort of realize that there's a kind of real-time conversation that's going on right now
yes.
on social media, so that, you know, whether you're Willa or Emily or anybody else writing about television, you kind of, you can't just sort of produce these kind of finished freestanding pieces. There's an ongoing dialogue that's going on in social media and a
yeah.
lot of cross-linking, which the New York Times is loath to do.
Right, absolutely. And so just like that there is such a rich conversation about television that's going on amidst different critics and fans and showrunners, you can find this on Twitter, and that that's something with which Stanley and most of the New York Times department don't choose to engage, I think it just it shows the ways in which the New York Times is still in some ways behind the times when it comes to television coverage.
Yeah, typically if they're writing about a trend on television, they're about a year and a half. I mean,
right.
like, they'll be writing like about cougars on television, like
yeah.
Yeah. about around the time that particular idea is playing out. All right, well, it's been great to talk to you. I hope you won't be a stranger. We actually do have a burning need for people with academic credentials who can talk about popular culture.
Wonderful,
so,
this is great.
We'll put you on speed dial. And Helen Peterson, the new book is Scandals of Classic Hollywood, Sex, Deviance, and Drama from the Golden Age of American Cinema. You can also read her on BuzzFeed. We are going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to move up a rung in the cultural hierarchy to the world of opera, the death of Klinghoffer specifically. All right. So I said to you at the beginning of the show that one of the themes of today's show would be that any industry, particularly any cultural industry, needs a certain amount of scandal. And the word scandal, I think we can use in a pretty broad way. And if there's one piece that I extracted that idea from, it is the one by our next guest, Raphael McGarrick, a graduate student in English literature at U of C Berkeley. And his work has appeared in the New Republic, Atlantic.com, and the Jewish Daily Forward. We're talking to him right now about the death of Klinghoffer. I am now going to do a horrible bit of name dropping and say that on Friday night I was interviewing Noam Chomsky on stage, and I brought up the death of Klinghoffer and got an earful about it. And you can probably guess what Noam Chomsky thinks about the furor over this. But Raphael McGarrick, I think, had a really interesting take on this. And so let's just set the stage first before we bring him aboard. Literally set the stage almost. So obviously the Metropolitan Opera is currently staging John Adams's opera, The Death of Klinghoffer. It's actually an opera that goes back to, I think, 91. So it's been staged before. This particular staging of it has excited, as did the original one, quite a bit of pro just entirely on the from the side of sympathizers with Israel, who feel as though Jews are depicted unfavorably, that the Palestinian terrorist viewpoint is over-legitimized in this opera. The negotiations between the ADL in particular, in the Anti-Defamation League, and the Met have resulted in some concessions, including the fact that a global HD simulcast of the opera was canceled. There's, I think, program notes from the daughters of Leon Klinghoffer, the man who was in 1985 shot and dumped over the side of the Achille Lauro cruise ship, which is the whole the source of this opera and the whole story of this opera. But there's been a lot of picketing and a lot of controversy and a lot of sound and fury and a lot of articles written about this. So, Raphael McGarrick, first of all, welcome to the show. And second of all, you're basically making the argument it might almost be kind of an everybody wins situation, in the sense that everybody, the world of art, the world of Zionism, the world of Noam Chomsky, everybody kind of gets to talk to their base about this.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. And I think that's exactly the argument I'm making. It works on two levels. On a basic level, publicity is really good for business. The Met is struggling. It's struggling this summer to fill. It turned out this summer that it's been struggling to fill seats. And it's also increasingly dependent on online donations for revenue. And you can imagine how a story like this, which is playing out, you know, in the pages of the New York Times, you know, and all across the media, is really tremendously good as publicity for the Met. But on a secondary level, I also think that there's an extent to which protest is part of the myth of modern art. It's part of what legitimizes high art. So when Joyce's Ulysses is stopped at the borders and is in fact censored, that's part of what canonizes that novel as a great modernist novel, that it offends people. So to that extent, I think really this controversy is great news for the Met and is great news for opera.
It is interesting, and although in fact, in an ideal world, the hysteria would be more about form. I mean, you think about 1913, The Rite of Spring, and then Schoenberg also, and had caused separate outcries and riots, basically, in their respective venues, not because of the content, not because there were dirty words or anti-Semitic content or anything, but just because the music was so weird and the choreography was weird, and it just people freaked out because they'd never seen art like this. And it seems as though that's a much more rare thing that, I mean, the most we can hope for in this day and age is, say, Mapplethorpe, where the content is, A, causing these huge lines at museums, and B, causing these, rabid denunciations.
Yeah, I think that to some extent, the riots surrounding the Rite of Spring, which, as you sort of brilliantly point out, are about form, depend on an audience with a strong set of pre-existing convictions as to what artistic form looks like.
Right.
Which we don't have to the same extent today. And there's not the same sense that how you would compose the harmonies, in a ballet is a matter to go and riot about. So things have changed in that way.
And one of the points that you make that I hadn't really thought about is that there's also kind of an interesting question of scale here, that, if the Sausalito Opera Company or something wants to do The Death of Klinghoffer, they're going to have a real problem, probably. If a lot of people object, I don't even know if there is such a thing, but a lot of people object, that's going to be a problem. Whereas the Met is sort of too, although it is, it turns out it's not too big to fail, it's like teetering on the verge of failure all the time, but it's big enough so it can say, we're doing this. And rather than, and we're going to be like the blob where the missiles you shoot into us make us stronger as opposed to destroying our season.
Right, and I think we definitely see in a number of ways how opera is no longer for the Met just what happens at Lincoln Center, right? So on the one hand, as you mentioned, the ADL concluded this deal about worldwide broadcasts. But on the other hand, the opera is a movie, right, which the Met doesn't benefit from, but which is part of the same kind of cultural phenomenon. And as I said, there's a whole lot of people who are interested followers of the Met who are reading about the story and feel engaged and connected to that cultural institution who aren't likely to set foot in the physical opera building. And so there are all sorts of questions that just don't come up for a smaller opera company, which is more local, because the Met is in fact a global brand.
And as you pointed out, or I guess it's an earlier DVD of The Death of Klinghoffer, in one category anyway on Amazon, was number two ranked in its category, I think between Annie and some version of a Fleetwood Mac concert.
Right.
It just doesn't happen with opera. There aren't opera DVDs that people want that much typically.
Right. I mean, for opera to reach into the world of Annie or Fleetwood Mac is to reach into the world of mass entertainment, of popular art. And that's probably, I would imagine, tremendously exciting for the company.
Although it does make me want to write an opera version of Annie in which Annie dies at the end with a score by Lindsey Buckingham. I think I would have something. I think that's sort of workable in some way. So, I mean, and you sort of wonder what we have to say one other thing, which is that in New York, any cultural controversy needs a whole bunch of things. It needs, obviously, cultural forces in conflict, all of whom seem to benefit, basically, synergistically from all the arguing that goes on. But it needs also one other thing. It needs Rudy Giuliani. I'm not quite sure why this is a law of nature, Raphael McGarrick, but it seems to be, right? You have to have Rudy Giuliani in the role of, it's almost an operatic role, an operatic role of the guy who hates whatever the latest thing is.
Yeah, I think especially for the New York Times, but probably for a lot of us, many of these cultural struggles become ways of moments in which we measure ourselves against the city we were in the 1990s. you know. So the incredible cultural struggles of the early 90s and then kind of the Sensation Exhibit, which was this famous moment in which Giuliani, you know, actually got in this incredible confrontation with the Brooklyn Museum, are very defining moments in New York, in recent New York memory. And so one of the things we do is we get to look back and say, you know, depending on which side we're on, well, look how different the city is. Now we have a mayor like Bill de Blasio who is basically seems happy about the opera, you know, and is not going to get involved in that fight. So the longer history, I think, you know, Giuliani's a very resonant figure, and it tells a lot about how the city has changed.
I mean, it's almost like you should send your press release to him because nobody would know the words elephant dung Virgin Mary just wouldn't even come up on search engines for you if it weren't for him. You have to make sure that he knows what you're doing. Well, Raphael McGarrick, I want to thank you for joining us. Actually, I think what I'm going to do now is work on an opera called Squeegee Man, you know, which will be sort of like the last Squeegee Man driven out of existence by Rudy Giuliani. So
if you write the music, I'll write the libretto.
All right. Good. Well, we both want to work on the libretto, it turns out. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. We'll be back after this. We have to have a conversation about baseball. We have to have a conversation about the World Series after this.
Is the next segment about the death of baseball? But I love baseball, especially now that there's a panda playing in the World Series. Oh, he's a person? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Jackie Filson. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tyrone Power. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff practicing semi-nude headfirst slides, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the story of Connecticut's shade tobacco. And now, back to Colin.
All right. So I've been thinking about baseball and about the World Series. Most of my thoughts, as tend to be the case, are wrong. But I wanted to have a conversation with someone who could tell me why my thoughts are wrong. And that's usually not difficult for me to do. I can usually find almost anybody who can tell me that I'm wrong. In particular, I wanted to talk to Brian Curtis. He's a staff writer at Grantland, the author of the article, The Dead Ball Century. He's one of the people who has been responding to the thoughts of people like me. When I watch the World Series, I think, I don't know, somehow or other, this doesn't feel like part of the national conversation the way I remember it being part of the national conversation. But maybe I don't remember it correctly anyway. It just seems somehow as though baseball doesn't sit on the pedestal that I remember from my youth. But memory is very deceptive. So let's begin with Brian Curtis. You've been responding to this, and you question that premise, right? That somehow or other there's this incipient dying out of the baseball flame.
Absolutely. I mean, in a number of different ways. And I think what you're talking about, what I keep hearing is that it's fallen out of the national conversation. And I think that's sort of an interesting way to look at it. And I think that's kind of part of my disagreement anyway with people that say baseball is dying starts, which is how you sort of define the terms of dying. What does dying mean? So anyway, I think, you know, part of the reason maybe is that the national conversation as we know it has changed, right? 20, 30 years ago, the national conversation meant appearing in newspapers and television ratings. And now the national conversation maybe means something like, you know, being on Twitter all the time or, you know, people watching it, you know, consuming a game on the web. So I think part of the problem here is the terms, right? Is baseball dying and by what metric is it dying?
Well, one metric that I would bring up, and it's a wildly imprecise metric, like all of my metrics, is the notion of sort of the crossover celebrity. So, I mean, in 1975, I mean, forget about the Yankees. Everybody else knows about the Yankees. In 1975, probably most Americans or many Americans, I told you this was an imprecise metric, knew who Carl Yastrzemski was. Like the name Carl Yastrzemski would be pretty recognizable in 1975. Sure. In 1985, the name George Brett, just to pick a Kansas City Royal, would have been really pretty widely recognized, crossover kind of person, the kind of person people kind of knew about, even though he wasn't playing for a major market team. And in the 90s, you know, pick somebody from the home run era or something like that. I feel like there isn't that now, that the panda notwithstanding, there just isn't, by the way, which is the name of my new novel, The Panda Notwithstanding. But, you know what I'm saying? I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this, though.
I think you're right, but I think that's actually a weird quirk, because I think in the last couple of years we haven't had one of baseball's big offensive stars in the World Series. You know, Madison Bumgarner's a really good baseball player, but he's not, you know, Yasiel Puig, right, or Mike Trout, somebody that would have had a bigger sort of thing, you know, a bigger sort of stature in the World Series. So I think that's actually what that is, you know, which doesn't really have anything to do with baseball dying out or being less popular, though you could argue maybe there's not a Yaz, a particular Boston star as big as Yaz right now. But I think that's just the teams that are making the World Series, not some statement about the sport generally.
Well, let's just talk about the World Series a little bit, too, because there's another interesting thing going on here, which is that these two teams, I mean, if you really love baseball, these teams are fabulous to watch, and they're not composed of stars. Maybe you can say a little bit more about this. Why, in fact, if more people are watching The Walking Dead than are watching the people running on the base paths, why that's a mistake, why this is actually worth watching right now?
Well, one thing that's funny is I went into this in a story in Graylin, which was that people have been declaring the death of baseball since just about the time that we had baseball in the United States. In fact, with a little help from the great historian John Thorne, we found the first baseball death notice, that is, the declaration that baseball was somehow dying or irrelevant, in 1868. And which is quite a ways back, and then we found them pretty regularly all the way up to now. I mean, when you talk about TV ratings, that's kind of an interesting way to say it, because you know, when you look at TV ratings, the New York Times did a story the other day where they said, oh, baseball is, you know, one of the World Series games had a lower rating than the Big Bang Theory, right? That sounds like a real sign of the times. But then I went back and looked at the 1985 ratings, right? This is when baseball is a much bigger deal, we think, in the national mindset. Well, several of the games finished with a lower composite rating than Murder, She Wrote. Now, I don't really know. I don't really understand why it's a big deal when it finishes lower than the Big Bang Theory now, when the last time the Royals were in it was finishing lower than Murder, She Wrote. Maybe you prefer Big Bang Theory to Jessica Fletcher's gum-shoeing. I don't know.
Well, although just for the sake of argument, I mean, one of the more damning statistics, I think I read that same article, that was that the first game of the World Series, and maybe the first two games of the World Series, had lower ratings than a pretty routine Sunday night football game. I think it was San Francisco-Denver. That's a little worrisome.
Yeah, football is a different story, though. So you talk about, you use the image of baseball not being on the pedestal it was. Direct you to a slightly different image where there is a parallel pedestal for the NFL, and it is bigger than anything we have in society right now, and its ratings make absolutely no sense when we look at the general decline of the networks and stuff like that. It seems to be completely decline-proof. So imagine you have a pedestal of baseball, and then you have this giant pedestal right next to it, then way in the air, it's National Football League. I saw a statistic the other day that CBS's pregame ratings are up by a substantial margin for the NFL this year. I mean, think about this. We live in this NFL, in this internet age, where there's literally not a single thing that TV show can tell you that you can't just get off the web in 5 seconds, right? And the people that want football information have all these resources, and yet more people are watching the NFL pregame show. So I just think part of the problem here is we keep comparing it to the NFL. Well, certainly the NFL is gigantically popular. It's the most popular. Everybody has to pick a favorite sport, they pick the NFL in all those surveys and have for many, many decades. But that doesn't mean that baseball's dying or, you know, falling off. It just means that there's something else that's very popular standing right next to it.
Yeah, so then the argument is the NFL is kind of sui generis, and that it's really about something else, right? It's whatever way our entire civilization is dying, it's a nice symbol of that. It's violent, it's amoral, it's run by people who are dreadful human beings who conceal vital medical data from their own employees about terrible damage being done to them in the course of their work lives. It's just the worst of every possible thing, and the worse it gets, the more we love it. So we're clearly locked locked in some kind of cultural death spiral with this thing that may have little to do with its appeal as sport. Is that the argument you're making, Greg?
I think you're proposing a separate think piece than all the death of baseball think pieces we've been reading. I'd also tell you that, you know, when we talk about enthusiasm for this World Series, if you went to one of those World Series in the 70s, some of those games did not exactly sell out, if memory serves. You know, if you went to, certainly by the late 60s and the early 70s, you know, we hear all these stories about these great, you know, sepia-toned baseball games of yore, right? Like Jackie Robinson's first game in Brooklyn, where there were more than 5,000 empty seats. The grand institution of baseball had been integrated. Or some of those World Series games where you and I could have walked up and bought a ticket right before the game, no problem. Imagine if we tried to do that in San Francisco last night, right? I think we would have had to, you know, throw out a few $100 just to get in the door. So, you know, we can look at it a lot of different ways, but there's certainly, I mean, a ton of enthusiasm around baseball right now, and lots and lots and lots of people are going to baseball games. And you know, you and I could make a call over to MLB, and I bet find out that there's record traffic on MLB.com this year, right? Which is another measure of popularity, another measure of how people are consuming the game.
I do think also, in a culture that's as balkanized as the way that you describe it, culture also moves in cycles and counter cycles. And whatever our weird relationship with the NFL is right now, it's kind of screaming for a counter cycle. And you know, this series is a nice bit of positioning for Major League Baseball. There aren't any preposterous jerks out there. There aren't any, for them that I'm aware of, people who are scandalous or objectionable. Instead, it's kind of this nice mix of athletes. They're good athletes. They do what they're supposed to do really well. You know, their statistical prowess is just sort of incredible. It seems like every night Joe Buck is saying that, you know, nobody's gotten a hit off this pitcher for 3.5 years or something. And so if you want to watch something that's an answer to everything else that seems to be going on in society, it seems like a pretty comfortable place right now.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that that Yost management style is pretty scandalous, right? I don't know, but yes, you're right. It does not have the overweening national scandal that it did a couple of years ago with steroids and stuff like that. I mean, what's funny, when you say it with cycles, it's very funny because it's also a very old argument that baseball is sort of out of step with our national mood. This comes up every few decades or so. In fact, I found a story from 1945 arguing that the game was outmoded, and then 1955 too, saying that, you know, baseball is being passed by more exciting sports, right? And this is 1955. This is the golden age of baseball that people of my generation feel we'll never ever, the boomers will never let us get out of. You know, oh, Mickey and Willie, oh my gosh, not this again. But even people in those days were saying that the game wasn't exciting enough for the times. So I think that's a very common thing too. You know, we always, for whatever reason it's baseball, we look at it and say, oh, you know, baseball's not a 2014 thing. That's an old thing. That's from a different, more innocent time. But even people in those more innocent times were saying the same thing.
Although, yes, but also people from those more innocent times say the same thing about now. I mean, some of the most relentless critics of modern baseball are former baseball players. We had a chance to interview Jim Bouton recently up in the Berkshires where he lives now. And, you know, I mean, he complains about the thing everybody complains about, which is the incredible delays in the game of people fixing their batting gloves and stuff like that. He said if you could eliminate Velcro, you could probably speed up the game, which is sort of counterintuitive when you think about it. But you know, you sort of wonder about that. Is that particular aspect of baseball so endemic to baseball that it shouldn't change it because it changes too much the nature of the game, the way that it is kind of a different kind of mental resting space? Or does baseball need to speed up to match digital culture and everything else?
I think you can speed it up a little bit without changing its fundamental nature as a resting space, as you say it. I don't think those two things are totally at odds. You know, I think you can make little rules that speed us up here and there. I think what Bouton is certainly a smart guy, but I think what, you know, a lot of this too with players is nothing is as good as the good old days, right? You know, I have old sports writers telling me all the time that sports journalism is terrible now. It's pretty good to me. And when I look at baseball, I think, you know, oh, you can't watch a game on TV. It takes so long. And I think, Jesus, a displaced Texas Rangers fan here living on the East Coast, I can watch every game with my MLB package at the tip of, at the punch of the remote control. Gosh, it seems like the golden age of baseball on TV to me. You know, I can watch more baseball than I ever wanted to. So, you know, and if I have to sit through, you know, 25 minutes of extra stuff in there. Somebody told me recently that no really good baseball game seems too long, and no really bad baseball game seems too short. Mm-hmm. But I agree. You can do some sort of stuff with the with the pace of play without you know, affecting the fundamental nature of the game, sure.
Well, Brian Curtis, this has been a great conversation. We didn't even have to bring up the other theory that you see on the Internet, which is that everything is Joe Buck's fault.
A whole segment for another time.
Actually, that's a whole show. The things that are Joe Buck's fault. We're doing a whole one-hour special on that. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right. And so that's Brian Curtis. He's a staff writer at Grantland and the author of the article, The Dead Ball Century. We've got all kinds of fun stuff coming up for you this week. And tomorrow we're taking a journey into the sepia-toned, as Brian Curtis would say, past, with the story of Shade Tobacco in the Connecticut Valley, which is an amazing story indeed. Thanks to everybody who helped out today. We'll see you tomorrow.
It's the right kind of day for a baseball game.
There's Jason Vargas with the pitch. And Bumgarner is rumored to have fathered an alien baby with Renee Zellweger. Isn't that something, Greg?
That's not as scandalous as Brandon Crawford playing the captain in Klinghoffer. I mean, Crawford's a tenor.
Yeah, tune in next time, am I right? No, seriously, please tune in next time.